Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
You directly lied to us this entire time. I can't believe they were dead all along. And they're going, no, they weren't dead all along. They were dead at the end.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region. No guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 118 of Recotopia. The big recommend today is Rashomon. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hi, Lily Host and Arenos.
And welcome, chat, who's coming out here on a Thursday. Yes, it's a very special Thursday. Recording of the episode. I don't think anything is going to make it particularly special just because it's Thursday, but it is a special Thursday recording of our show. I will start us off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
So I decided to watch a couple of shorts this weekend, some movies that one I had seen, one I had not before. The one I had not seen was The Red Balloon, which is a French short. And I believe both of the ones that I watched are French shorts. The Red Balloon, is from 1956, and it is about a boy who unties a balloon from a lamppost doing his own stunts. I might add, I thought that was a pretty cool thing. you can't do that today. Probably.
Nope. You're not sending a kid up that lamppost these days.
Hell no. And he gets the balloon, and of course he grows attached to it, and after a while he learns that he can command the balloon to go wherever he goes. And of course he goes into a bunch of lovely misadventures with the balloon. Nobody seems to like the balloon. They don't want him on they don't want him on the bus to school, so he has to run to school. He can't have it inside the school. He can't take it anywhere, but the balloon follows anyway. And through some tricks that I'm sure are wires and things of that nature, they are dragging the balloon around, following this kid everywhere he goes. Of course, you can't have too much fun with a balloon because your classmates will eventually want to bully you over it and either steal the balloon or destroy the balloon. So that's what the most of the last part of this short film is him trying to protect the balloon in some way, and has a beautiful ending as well. So I enjoyed it very much.
I love this short. There's a couple things with this. Number one, if you look at my pictures of when I was like 6-7 years old, I look exactly like this kid. Like, there's like, I feel like I'm watching old home movies or something when I watch this this short. And then the other part of it is there's this, you can overlay your own metaphor on this movie for sure. But like, for me, the balloon represents joy and optimism and love and like all these positive things in life that we find, and they excite us and they're great to have as a companion. And then just the world just wants to choke those things out of us. Just like, you know, say, you know, how dare you be optimistic? How dare you have joy right now? You know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And I think the movie does a really, really good job at capturing that feeling and that emotion. And like you said, it's a beautiful ending as well. So yeah, this movie speaks to me in a lot of ways. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My first small recommend, I'll go to the show I saw in Vegas. We'll talk about Dead and Company, Dead Forever at the Sphere in Vegas. Really is an opportunity to talk about the venue as much as the concert, because this is something, if you ever get a chance to do, I would highly recommend that you do, no matter who is playing there. I'm not necessarily a Grateful Dead fan. In fact, this is my first Dead show. You know, Dead and Company, of course, is the touring band after the Grateful Dead kind of finished up when Jerry Garcia passed away. And so John Mayer is in this now, doing some vocals and doing lead guitar. And the show itself was a good show. I was really impressed with the artistry. John Mayer is maybe the best guitar player I've ever seen live. He's just incredible. Like, there are certain people who play the guitar and you watch them and they're like, oh, you're singing with your instrument. Like, you are, as easy as it is for some people to vocalize, that's what you are doing. You just, you know, it comes like instinctively to him. So he was incredible to watch. But really, this was about the venue itself. The Sphere, if you don't know anything about it, is both externally and internally a highly advanced audiovisual system. I guess externally it's just visual. Internally it's audio as well. The external sphere, which is not a complete sphere, by the way, but enough of one that it, you know, you can tell like it starts to curve back in towards the ground. So like you can see it's like a ball sitting in a like a ring or something like that.
Right.
And the external lights are so bright that even in the complete daytime sun, you can see what's on the sphere, which is absolutely incredible. At night, it's just like amazing to look at that thing and the projections that are on it. Inside is even more spectacular. The visuals are not only high resolution, but they are completely surrounding you. I mean, they stop behind you, but like all the way over to the back, all the way to the sides. So whatever is put on the quote-unquote screen, the interior of the dome, is completely enveloping. And so the result is, with the frame rate and the high resolution and being involved, it tricks your mind into thinking what's in front of you is real. And so there was, I think, one moment where they were like playing out in a desert and there was a Sphinx behind them. I kept looking at that Sphinx going, that's a real Sphinx behind them. I like, it looks so real. And part of that also is the contrast, because like there are these really bright lights next to these dark darks. And so, you know, it just, again, it really feels like you're seeing something. The part I wasn't ready, well, there's two parts I wasn't ready for that also made this incredible. One is the audio experience. I didn't realize how high tech the audio experience in this building is, because they have this screen all around. They have speakers strategically placed in the entirety of the dome, so that it can target every section with the same mix. So, you know, you go to a concert and like, if you sit up front at a concert, you may need to wear headphones, whatever, because, you know, the speakers are going to be blasting. If you sit too far back, sometimes there's like a weird echo, and sometimes it feels like it's not loud enough. Every seat in the Sphere gets the same audio experience because of the way it's set up. And therefore, it is the most finely tuned, like, live audio experience I've ever had. I was blown away by the sound. And then the second part I didn't really think about is the integration of the live picture as well. Because the stage is it's teeny tiny. Like, you know, it looks like, you know, little ants down there performing on stage. And so they project the cameras up onto the screen, but it's integrated into like the special effects and those kind of things. So for instance, at one point there's a whole bunch of Grateful Dead posters that are, you know, the huge backdrop. Well, some of those posters are actually the live video of John Mayer playing, or the guy playing the piano, or, you know, the guy playing the drums. And it's just really, really impressive that they have the processing power to do it. There are also seat vibrations, and the Grateful Dead have a famous drum solo thing that they do in the middle. Not technically a drum solo. It's like three or four people that do all these drums. And each of the different drums was connected to a different part of the seat. So like when one drum would play, you like the big bass drum, like your butt would rattle. And then if, you know, like some of the mid drum, you know, be in the middle of your back, and then the, you know, the higher drums would be in the top of your back. So as they're playing, you're feeling the different kinds of drums in the seat. I was blown away. I told my wife, I said, like, this is one of those things where every time there's a new band playing the Sphere, I'm just going to look at what flights cost. That's all. I just like, it's so cool. I just want to see everybody play there. So yeah, it was amazing.
I can't remember what the resolution was on the screen in this thing, but I remember, like, you just imagine your best TV that you can buy and then multiply by maybe 10,000. It's something absurd.
Ridiculous. Yeah,
like it's never, like it's probably the crispest screen you've ever seen. Even when you just showed us a video from your phone on this thing, I was like I can imagine some people getting dizzy and you know, like the visuals actually making them feel something where they might have to like take some medicine or something to like get over it.
It was a dead show, so there were plenty of people taking medicine.
That is a salient point. Yes. I need to get inside that Sphere one day, man.
Yeah.
I have seen it from the outside, but I need to see something. Okay. My next small recommend is another short from 1962 called La Jetée, which is the basis for 12 Monkeys that came out in 1995. I had seen this before, but I think it was one of those things where it was like, it's not 12 Monkeys. So, you know, I don't know if I like this or not. Now, having some distance from it, I was able to watch it one more time, and I really, really enjoyed this. In fact, I felt quite emotional watching it. Even it was it's a very touching movie. If you're familiar with 12 Monkeys, you know the sort of the beginning of this. But the thing about this movie is it's all still frames. There's only one shot of actual motion picture in this. And I wonder if they did that just to say they qualified as a motion picture. I don't know. But it's all still frame. So it's still frames and narration. And the narrator tells you at the very beginning, when I was a young boy, I was on this pier, which is what La Jetée means. I was on this pier and I saw this woman. And then I saw this man die in front of my eyes. And that's all he remembers, because then World War III starts. And before you know it, we're whisked into some underground area where some survivors have collected, and there are all these German scientists who are trying to figure out, how do we get out of this situation? And they have sort of found a way to do time travel, but they don't know how it's going to work yet. So they have to get basically some guinea pigs to go out there and do this stuff. So they in 12 Monkeys, you remember the story was they wanted Bruce Willis to find clues to things that could help them. This is more about the experiment than it is about trying to figure out how to solve the problem that they're in. So they send him back to this certain time, and it just so happens to be the time where he was living as a kid, and he meets this woman that was a part of his memories. And part of the reason why he was selected was because he had such a strong memory of this before the war started. And they start kind of like having a friendship/relationship type of thing. But every time he gets to a certain point, the scientists pull him back to the place where they're doing the experiment. And so basically, if you think about it from this woman's perspective, this guy is just disappearing right in front of her eyes as he goes back and forth. And then as he comes back again and they meet again, she calls him his ghost as he keeps coming back. This movie is just, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking the first time I watched it, because the first time I guess maybe I must have like lost some concentration or something watching. This is a beautiful, beautiful short film that I recommend very highly to everyone. And especially if you love 12 Monkeys and you wanted to see sort of the basis for this and everything, this is a kind of a completely different story, although you'll kind of know where things are going. But it's really, really good. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it before, so I popped it up on Criterion, which has it, and yeah, really enjoyed it. You mentioned the one section that is has a little actual movement, and it just rocked me. Like, and I think mm-hmm. that's the intent, because you go through enough of it where it's just like, you know, still pictures, and you just think, oh, that's what this is. It's kind of, you know, the world's most arty PowerPoint. is, you know, kind of what we're dealing with here. And then mm-hmm. it gets to that section, and the video is of her like looking up and smiling, and it mm-hmm. just like, you're just like, ah, beauty, grace, love, I'm in love. Yes. Yeah. And it's really, really effective. I think it's great. And I think it's specifically, if you love 12 Monkeys, which I do, mm-hmm. I'm really glad that I've kind of seen where it came from, because a lot of what I really love about 12 Monkeys are the parts that come from this short, you know, kind of the structure of it and, you know, the denouement of the movie. But yeah, it's really, really good. Even if most of it is, you know, just still frames, a very low frame rate. That's my review. Just a real, yeah. real low frame rate.
Exactly. Lajete means pier, guys. You're like down there asking what it means. Lajete mm-hmm. is the pier.
The pier. So, mm-hmm. My second small recommend is a documentary called Movie Pass, Movie Crash.
Oh, I remember that.
This, I think, is on Max, if I'm remembering correctly. It is an original doc that they put together. Yeah, most of us remember MoviePass when it happened, and I, like many, many people, when they dropped it down to whatever it was, $10 a month mm-hmm. for unlimited movies. And I just remember saying at that time, I don't know how they're making a business out of this, but I'm going to take advantage of it until, you know, it goes down, and go down it did in flames. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes into the details of what happened. The most revelatory part of this documentary for me was that the two guys that crashed this business, that basically, you know, through Fire Festival, we hear of all these things where it's just like, yeah, fake it till you make it. And, you know, all it's kind of that kind of thing. They weren't the creators of MoviePass. In fact, the creators of MoviePass were a couple of black men. And they got completely shoved aside by these, you know, older white tech bros. And there's a really interesting and tragic story about that and how that happened that I found really worthwhile in understanding. This is a really good documentary. I don't know that you'll see it in the best docs, you know, Oscar race or anything, but it's I think it's really worth a watch. So mm-hmm. I think that's on Max. Movie Pass, Movie Crash mm-hmm. is the name.
Yeah. And of course, after that, all the theaters were like, well, we can do this on our own. We don't need anything that, you know, we don't need a third party to do this. So.
Well, and that's a frustrating part, too. You listen to the original creators talking about it, and, you know, they were one of the, it felt like one of the reasons they got kind of dumped from to the side was because they were like, look, let's make this sustainable. Let's figure this out. And the people who had been put in charge because they had contacts to the money or whatever were just like, no, all we need to do is get 5 million subscribers. We just need subscribers, mm-hmm. subscribers, subscribers, subscribers. We don't need to, you know, make money. The money will come once we get the subscribers. Yeah. And there is a world where if they're smart about a promotional period, maybe where it's $10 a month and then, you know, and then it goes up to a more reasonable 20, 25, 30 or whatever it really should be.
Yeah.
That kind of works, and they have deals with the movie theater chains, and, you know, we don't have, you know, AMC A-List and, you know, whatever Regal's version is or Alamo's version is. Mm-hmm. But it changed the game for sure. Like, it, you know, there are a lot of people that subscribe to a monthly movie pass type thing, and it wasn't even in existence before this. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. On to our big recommend. That would be 1950s Rashomon.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so
big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Our movie begins in beautiful downtown Rashomon. Come for the tales of the human condition. Stay for the free baby giveaway. Anyway, we're in the middle of a downpour in a village of ruins. Two men sit and think about the story they heard but cannot understand. Is it the movie Midsummer? Only time will tell. They are soon joined by a third party, a commoner, who asks why the hell they seem so morose. It seems they were witness to the aftermath of a crime of some sort, and they went to a courthouse garden to hear three sides to a story. One of the men, a priest, says he's seen a lot of death due to war, famine, disasters, and plagues in his day. Then humanity was shaken by this story. The first witness, a woodcutter, thinks that maybe the man who's just arrived can make sense of what they know. So he tells them, maybe you can make sense of all this, and launches into a tale that began 3 days ago when he went into the mountains to get some wood. As he Hakuna Matatas his way through the woods, he discovers a woman's hat caught in some bushes, a samurai's cap on the ground, some rope, an amulet case, and absolutely nothing else you could possibly trip over and get frightened of. Spoke too soon, he trips over a dead man's body. He runs to tell the police. A horizontal wipe takes us to the courtyard garden, where he speaks directly in front of the camera to an unseen judge and jury who may or may not be enjoying a large buttered popcorn and some junior mints off screen. He denies seeing a sword, but he inventories the other stuff. Now the movie transitions to the priest's side of the story in the courthouse. He says he met the murdered man before his death. The woman was riding a white horse, and her husband, armed with a sword and bow and arrows, was walking beside them. Then a police officer sits next to a man who is all tied up named Tajimaru. And I'm sure I'm screwing that name up, but I'm going to say Tajimaru was his name, played by Toshiro Mifune. I'm sure I'm messing that name up too, but he was a huge international star and played in all the Akira Kurosawas pretty much after this. We find out he's an infamous bandit who has for years apparently been able to tell the cops, this is the day you almost caught Tajimaru. The cop apparently found an upset Tajimaru lying on a riverbank next to a white horse with arrows strewn all about on the ground. The police officer believes the bandit was thrown from the horse, but Tajimaru quickly corrects him that he was very thirsty while riding the horse and then drank water from a stream that must have been poisoned by a snake upstream, because that's how poison works. And so when he tried to ride the horse again, he got sick, and what he actually did was get off the horse like a normal, unembarrassed human. Now Tajimaru is ready to tell us what happened, unafraid of the truth, because he knows he's done for anyway. So you know you can trust every word he says. Three days ago, he was sleeping on a hot day and a cool breeze woke him up. He sees the husband and wife traveling through the woods. After the husband approaches the bandit cautiously and moves on, Tajimaru gets a glimpse of some ankle and a face under a veil and instantly falls in love. Now his thoughts turn toward how he can take the woman by force without killing the husband. But if he had to, he would. By the way, and I know that I'm halfway through this and everything, but there are going to be some triggers here. I'm probably going to say the word rape, because the movie in 1950 couldn't say rape, but that is what is happening here. So just wanted to let everybody know. His idea is to tell the man that he has swords and mirrors buried in a ruin somewhere close so he can get the husband away from his wife. He pulls out a sword as if to fight the man right then and there, but then says, hey man, don't be so suspicious. His story about the swords and mirrors seems compelling enough for the husband, and so they leave the wife behind to get them. Tajimaru ends up getting the drop on the man and ties him up. He then goes back to find the wife and tells her that her husband has become sick. When he sees her expression, he decides this isn't about just taking the woman anymore. He wants to humiliate the husband too. So they run back to the place where he's tied up. The wife tries to kill Tajimaru with a dagger, but this leads to the inevitable. He overtakes her and rapes her right there in front of the husband. According to Tajimaru, she initially resists, but eventually welcomes the bandit's advances. And he believes he's got the best of both worlds. He got what he wanted and didn't kill the husband. But because the wife has a sense of honor that requires only one man to know about what just happened, she begs Tajimaru to duel her husband, and whoever wins that battle will win her. After a bit of feeling out, the bandit wins the duel, even embellishing that the samurai fought like no one had ever fought him before. After the duel is done, the woman has run away, and all that is left is the horse. He says that he takes the samurai sword and sells it for liquor, but somehow forgot about the wife's valuable dagger. We come back to Rashomon, where the commoner adds even more to the legend of Tajimaru, claiming he must have been behind the deaths of a woman and her maid, even though there's no proof of that. Now the priest explains that the wife showed up to the courthouse after being found hiding in a temple. The woodcutter believes that the story Tajimaru told and the wife told are both lies. A philosophical discussion about why people lie begins, ending with the commoner saying, "I don't care if people lie as long as it's entertaining, wink, wink." The priest tells the commoner that the wife's story was completely different from Tajimaru's. First off, the woman doesn't seem as fierce as Tajimaru said she was. She is first seen in the courthouse crying. She confirms the part of the story that everyone agrees on. She was taken by force by Tajimaru. She says that after that, she tried to talk to her husband, but her husband had nothing but hate for her in his eyes. She asks him to give her every punishment he can so that he can start loving her again. She gets the idea to grab the dagger and tells her husband to kill her, but he does nothing. She approaches him with the dagger, but then claims she blacked out. When she woke up, her husband was dead with her dagger in his chest, not remembering when she left the woods. She also tried to end her own life. The commoner agrees that this story is confusing, but you have to beware of the woman's story because women get fooled by their own tears or some nonsense. The men are such feminists in this movie. If only we could hear the dead man's story. It's really too bad that we can't get his perspective. Oh, wait, you're saying we can? That there's a Whoopi Goldberg who can tell us his story? What a glorious day. There is a discussion that even the dead man must be lying, but the priest holds out hope that there must be someone good in this story. The commoner doesn't think so. Is there anybody who is truly good? Men who only remember the fake good stuff and nothing that they ever did bad. The medium tells the husband's story, even taking on the voice of the man through her. He speaks from a darkness, thinking it to be some form of hell. Again, we all agree that Tajimaru raped his wife. In this version, the bandit tries to console his wife and claims that Tajimaru made her believe that she could no longer be with her husband after this and that she should marry him because, after all, he only did this out of love. Apparently, she agreed to this arrangement. And that wasn't all. She wanted Tajimaru to kill her husband. At this, the bandit is so mortified that he tells the husband he will kill her himself for such an evil idea. All he has to do is nod. And because of this, the husband is even willing to forgive Tajimaru for his crime. While Tajimaru tries to get an answer, the wife runs away. When the bandit returns without the wife, he cuts the husband loose. He walks into the woods, sees the dagger, and ends his own life. The husband's final words are that he remembers someone removing the dagger from his chest before he finally went into darkness. Now the woodcutter is upset because he doesn't even believe there was a dagger. This intrigues the commoner, who gets the woodcutter to admit he saw the whole thing, but did not tell the court about it. He says he didn't want to get involved. The woodcutter says that after he found the hat, he found the woman crying. He saw a man tied up, and he saw Tajimaru. He claims Tajimaru was on his knees begging the woman for forgiveness. This time, he feels bad about something he did because he actually cares for her. He bargains with her. "I'll even stop being a bandit. I have money, but if you don't want my dirty money, I'll do something stupid like get a job." However, if she refuses him, he has no choice but to kill her. She says, "I'm a woman. I don't get to decide," leaving the bandit to believe she means that he and her husband need to duel for her heart. However, the husband isn't having it. He doesn't want to be with a woman who's been with two different men. He even tells her to kill herself. He'd rather lose her than the horse. The bandit hears the husband's words and says, "Damn, maybe you're right." But when the husband continues to berate the wife, that's when Tajimaru gets mad and tells him to stop bullying her. The bandit says that women are weak, which spurs the wife to get up and yell at her husband, "Why aren't you killing this man who did this to me? Only then can you tell me to kill myself. And oh, by the way, Tajimaru, you're no real man either." She even thought it might be a good thing to run across this infamous bandit and take her away from this boring daily routine. But turns out you suck just as much as my husband. Real men fight for women they love. And so the duel begins. The fight is not so epic. They are both scared men. Tajumaru even sticks his sword so hard in the ground trying to kill the husband that he can't get it back for a while, and he runs around avoiding him. But at some point, the husband's sword gets stuck in a log, and Tajumaru is able to retrieve his own sword, which he uses to stab the husband in the chest. After the deed is done, the woman does not want to go with Tajumaru and eventually runs away. The bandit takes both swords with him and leaves the picture. Back at Rashomon, the commoner thinks the woodcutter is lying. After all, he lied about what he knew in the first place, so why should we trust his account? I don't know. Let's have a sudden baby crying out of nowhere. Maybe this is just the coda we need. The commoner wants to steal the kimono off the baby. The woodcutter says it's wrong to do something like that, but the commoner says someone else would have taken it if I didn't, so it's actually okay, you see? And besides, the parents of this kid just clearly just decided to have recreational sex and not face the responsibility. But the woodcutter says he's wrong. Look at the amulet on the kimono. That was clearly meant to protect the baby. We don't know what people are thinking and can't judge. The commoner eventually shames the woodcutter. He's a liar, and he also definitely took that mysterious dagger no one can seem to find from the crime scene. The commoner runs off with the kimono. The rain finally stops, and the woodcutter tries to take the baby from his hands. From the priest's hands. The priest thinks that he wants to steal more stuff off the baby, but the woodcutter says no. I have 6 kids and I want to add cousin Oliver to my own personal Brady Bunch. The priest thinks this selfless act proves that he can have faith in mankind, even if the woodcutter isn't a perfect person. The woodcutter walks away from Rashomon with the baby in hand, and the movie ends. Aaron, what did you think of Rashomon?
Long on my list of shame. Glad to have seen it this week. It's clearly really, really good. I'm not breaking any news by saying that.
Right.
I was surprised at the message of the movie, because in my mind, so much of the Rashomon thing has to do with perspective, right? And how different people have different perspectives. In my mind, it's like the story of the blind men and the elephant, right? This is the famous story where the blind men all come up on an elephant, but they all use their hands to feel different parts of the elephant. Therefore, they describe the elephant differently. That's what I thought Rashomon was. It's not that, though. That's a portion of it, but this movie is not amoral. It's not saying, hey, we all have different perspectives, and, you know, therefore we don't know the truth. It's saying we're all human and therefore craft our narratives to make ourselves look good. Like, that's a different kind of message that's going on here. And it's really intelligent and I think appropriate and relevant for all of us, because it's true. As humans, lying is part of what we do, whether it's, you know, in small ways or large ways, because we all want to appear good. We all want to appear strong. We all want to, you know, whatever the case may be. And so we nuance, you know, things to make us feel good about ourselves or to look better or whatever the case may be. And this movie is saying, in this tragic, terrible situation, every single person, when they told the story, made themselves the hero, or made themselves look better, or made themselves, you know, found the narrative that fit with their perspective. And man, that's a sticky, tricky kind of thing to process through. Because, like, again, the movie says, even at times, sometimes we don't even know we're doing it. Sometimes we're lying to ourselves about who we are. And it's just, you know, as I continue to get older in age, it continues to become obvious to me about how performative we all are, about how we all craft our narratives to fit how we see the world and how we see ourselves and how we see others, and why that's one of the biggest obstacles to understanding each other, is because we have different narratives that feel right for us or make us feel good about the world or whatever the case may be. Man, that's heady stuff for, you know, this morality tale, but it's more than I had bargained for. Again, because the Rashomon type movies I've seen are more about just different perspectives, you know, now let's see it from this different view. And this movie had a very specific point of view. It is interesting to me that Kurosawa ends optimistically. That's interesting to me that the movie tries to find optimism amongst this message. I like that. I appreciate that. And I think that is a good thing to keep in mind about the duality of humanity, that, you know, even though we all, you know, try to craft these positive narratives about ourselves, there is goodness in humanity as well. And so I did appreciate that. But yeah, I had a really good experience with it. I think the performances are amazing. I haven't, you know, started even talking about the technical things with the movie, but I think the performances are great. They're a little over the top, although that's kind of the style of the time. Especially the bandit is, you know, maniacal laugh, you know, many, yes. many times.
Yes.
But it's of course shot amazingly. I read some research about this was the first time a movie had ever shot directly into the sun, which I thought was cool.
Oh, really?
That it was like a no-no. And then I think it was, I think Kurosawa says it was his, photographer's idea. And so they did it and they liked the way it looked. It also, honestly, I didn't see any of this, but it also goes with the themes too. When you've got the sun casting shadows and these moving leaves and everything, like if the sun represents truth, then the forest represents the ways the truth changes and the ways it can shadow things. And, you know, so there's some interesting thematic things there as well. But yeah, it's just a really well done, like you mentioned last week, nice quick 90 minute, you know, morality tale, where everybody has an angle. Everybody has a reason they're telling the story they're telling, including, you know, our, you know, woodcutter and priest and everybody. So, so yeah, I really, really loved it.
Yeah. I want to get to this one comment from R1MA78. The woodcutter is Takahashi Shimura. Yes, I knew I had seen him before, and I, for some reason, did not go back to look at where I had seen him. He'd been in a ton of Kurosawa movies, including the first couple of Godzillas. Thank you for that comment, by the way, because I knew I had seen him. In fact, there's probably other actors in here that went on to have tremendous careers that I just, you know, that we just don't know as well here in the States.
Yeah.
And everything. My question to you, Aaron, is after you've heard the four stories, which one do you think is, do you think the woodcutter is telling 100% the truth? That's the movie's version of the 100% of the truth. Or is that again, yet another perspective that we have to worry about, in this? He's the thing about the woodcutter's story is that there's nothing in it that is making him look good at all. It's just what he remembers. Now, it could be something about memory or whatever, but I felt like the movie is saying that was the truth right there. But what do you think?
I think it's, well, the first thing I think is I don't know that the movie needs us to find the true story. Like, I don't know that that's the point. However, I felt the same way you did in that that felt to the like the closest version to what happened. Although I think what we're supposed to be seeing in his story, correct me if I'm wrong, because again, there was a lot, but I think in his story, he took the dagger, right? Like that's the idea. Yeah. He left that part out because he wanted to make himself look good.
Sure.
And so again, there's that theme again, even when you feel like you have the most objective view of what's going on, there's still a part of it that that person personally didn't want to tell or shade it or whatever.
In this case, he doesn't want to tell his story because not because he doesn't want to get involved, but he doesn't want to hear questions about the dagger.
About the dagger. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I found a lot of the stories interesting in a way, like I feel like the bandit story, making him look good is more about his power and what he's doing and like, yeah, I took that woman. That's not a big deal. Yeah, I had a epic sword fight with a samurai, and and he was the toughest person I've ever fought in my life. But I came out of it alive. Mm-hmm. Of
course, yep.
When we get to the truth at the end, we find out both of them are scared and you know don't have any real bravery in the situation. They don't want to do it.
Their sword fight, from that perspective, may have been my favorite moment of the movie when they're just like totally timid and not wanting to do it. And I was like, oh, that's great. That's so great. Yeah, I loved that.
But what I found interesting about the wife's story is it especially if we're comparing it to what the truth is later, if we're saying that the woodcutter right. story is the truth, is why is she saying that she approached him with it? Is it because that I feel like the husband and wife are defending each other in some ways in this, in these stories? Like, you know, I feel like the wife is saying, I approached him. I don't know what happened. I blacked out. And when I came to, oh, there was a dagger in his heart. But to tell the story of him being a coward is something that she didn't want to do in the courthouse. Meanwhile, the medium telling the husband's story, the husband says, oh, well, you know, we did get into a duel, and then we were going to get into a duel, but then I was so ashamed of what had happened, I ended my own life. And that could be protecting his wife as well, because his wife, but then again, if we're talking about, again, if we're talking about that fourth story kind of screws up everything, because you're just kind of like, all right, I think I kind of have an idea of why they're lying. Not necessarily what the truth is, but why are they lying in this? What are they lying about? Was a very interesting thing to me. But yes, at the end, I guess he was saying, I had dignity at the end. You know, I didn't want to take my wife who's known two men, you know, so now I'm just going to end it on my own. And I didn't get into a scared fight with a bandit.
Yeah. There's probably some cultural things we're missing too. I mean, I think even just down to my limited understanding of the cultures, you know, suicide for us is, you know, something that in broad terms is looked down on, right? Like you know, you hear people talking about it as the coward's way out, or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. I'm not espousing any of this. I'm just talking culturally. Yes. And then, you know, culturally in that culture, it's an honor thing. Like you think of seppuku and these things that, you know, are part of the culture, and dying an honorable death, you know, suicide is, you know, I'm dying with honor. So there is probably a little bit of cultural difference there that makes it, you know, more difficult for us to understand how him taking his own life was him shading the narrative in a positive way. You know, kind of thing. But yeah, I think that's, there's probably several things like that, you know, we just wouldn't necessarily pick up on, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, unless we have other things to add to this, let's go to our super secret double feature.
Hi, podcast listeners. Danae here, and I want to tell you about Mint Mobile, because they saved me money, and I appreciate that. Mint Mobile also made it easy to save money on my phone plan. So here's how it works. Here's how to get great wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of their three-month plan. You go to mintmobile.com/recotopia, and you're going to see all of their plans. And right now, all of the three-month plans are just $15 a month, and that includes the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your number along with all of your existing contacts. And that's it. That's how easy it is. Just you go and you look at the information, you're like, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? The hardest part is just deciding to break up with your current phone people. To get this new customer offer and your three-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That is mintmobile.com/recotopia, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. Heads up, $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to the $15 a month, and new customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Man, I went back and forth on this one quite a bit, but eventually I landed with a choice that I will try to justify.
Oh.
I think this is a good double feature with Vertigo.
Okay.
And the reason I eventually landed here.
I already see it.
There's a lot here that has to do with the stories we tell ourselves, the lot that has to do with creating our own realities, crafting narratives, and, you know, what is true is what this woman is, saying true, and, you know, what actually happened in the end. It felt, if nothing else, a spiritual kinship with a lot of the themes and stuff that's going on in Rashomon, and just really felt like a decent double feature to me. So
it's funny. Yeah. This all comes kind of it all kind of comes full circle, because in the short recommend or the small recommend of La Jetée, they are pointing to a tree trunk of like all this different the years
and everything, yeah.
Which is what 12 Monkeys actually shows Vertigo in the mm-hmm. movie, and
yeah.
then Vertigo, of course, here. So I'm gonna go with, not only is that a great choice, but it's a great synergy choice as well for our
yeah.
program today. So yeah, very, very good.
I'll tell you, the other one I almost landed on was Anatomy of a Fall, which feels like it has a lot of the same themes as well.
Another movie that, I don't know if it's a spoiler to say how it goes, but one that doesn't have easy answers. Let's say that.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
There you go.
All right. What is our big recommend for next week? Our homework for next week?
I am going to go with a movie that has been in the news a little bit lately for various mm-hmm. reasons, and one of my favorite movies of all time, one of the most prescient movies I think I've ever seen. We're going to talk about Her next week. So
this is such a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah. I can't wait to dive into this again. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I've probably seen it 3 times, so it's really mm-hmm. good. I can't wait
yeah.
to see it again. Okay, I guess we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Okay, if you met someone who had never seen a movie in their life, what would you show them first?
Never seen a movie in their life. It's hard for me not to go with my favorite movie, so I will do that plus a little addendum. I would show them Singing in the Rain first, immediately followed by Babylon, and give them the full width and breadth of, you know, what movies can do. So yeah,
okay.
That would be my choice.
All right. I'm going to go with Die Hard. I know that seems, I don't know, that seems like a weird first movie for somebody, but I feel like that has like everything you want in a movie, maybe. Like great plot, great performances, awesome action. It's what you will judge all of your action movies by from that point forward. So maybe it's not the best first movie for somebody, but I think there's so many things interesting about Die Hard that it would be a great first movie for somebody.
I thought about going the route of like what would blow their mind the most. Like it would be like showing them Jurassic Park or something, and they're just wait, are dinosaurs real?
Right, exactly.
But yeah, that'd be fun.
In the chat, we have Castriff says The Lion King would be a solid choice. I agree. Wang says Bulletproof. I hope that's not that Adam Sandler movie you're talking about. I don't know if there's another Bulletproof. Michael Menza says Princess Bride or Slab always in with the Sin City. Eight says The Prestige,
which is that's a good one.
That's a great, great movie. On to another question. What is an IP that you have long known and loved that has yet to be turned into a movie?
For this one, I went with Lost. And it's interesting because to re-engage with Lost would be a very interesting project, a very interesting IP project. But I do think there's ways to take the universe that was built there and, you know, find, you know, different points of interest to make a movie about. There could be a really interesting movie about the origins of the island, that kind of stuff, that kind of expands on what some of the last season did. I went with Lost.
Were you one of the people, like me, who was super disappointed in the last season and last episode?
I was not. In fact, I've been an apologist for the final episode since it aired. And I think I get it. Like, I totally understand why people didn't like it. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with how pop culture was integrating into this new internet world where they were right on the cusp of, you know, fanboys in comments and all that, you know, like that kind of stuff. And so they were treading this really interesting territory. When I say they, I mean Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof, the creators and showrunners of the show, where they're doing a weekly podcast. They're making all these declarations. They're saying, yes, we do have answers. We do have somewhere we're going. We know, you know, what the final shot of the show will be. And I think that set up some expectations for people that were just impossible to fulfill. They were never going to answer every question fully. I do think they answered a lot more than people give them credit for. But that that final season, I think, was so severely misunderstood because people were wanting bows and they wanted to continue the themes and that kind of stuff. So
I read a thing after it ended. I was years after it ended, where someone who was an apologist, much like you, had said, this is shortening and summarizing what he said about a lot of this last season was most of the stuff comes down to island magic. You're like, it's island magic at the end. Like, you're wanting to have a real solid explanation for things. It's usually just island magic. And I think a lot of times, because we were hoping that there was like an actual like scientific reason for a lot of things. Especially the way the show is showing you scientists and that was an experiment and all this stuff. I think everybody's like set up for something more than island magic. So, I can totally see why if you're not, you know, on that kind of like plane, you could be like, okay, I can enjoy this or whatever. So,
and I think there was a subset of fans who were told that, you know, from the very beginning, it's not purgatory, it's real. And then they misinterpreted the last season to be, oh, actually it was purgatory, which is not what that last season is doing. But so there was definitely a feeling with a subset of fans of like, you directly lied to us this entire time. I can't believe they were dead all along. And they're going, no, they weren't dead all along. They were dead at the end. They all died in different times and places. Anyways,
I got a couple of answers to this. I don't know how popular this series of books was back in the day. They made tons of them. I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of these kind of series out there, but The Three Investigators, did you ever read any of those at all as a kid? It's three friends. One's led by Jupiter Jones, who, by the way, may be more famous for Jupiter Ascending these days because Mila Kunis plays Jupiter Jones in that movie. But this is, you know, obviously a completely different thing. The three investigators, and they were all, I mean, you wouldn't have to make like major movies out of them. These could be like a Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs type of thing. They're not goofy like that. It's just, it's these are just mysteries and everything. And I'm kind of surprised they were never made into movies, but maybe they were never that popular. Maybe not enough people knew about them and everything. I don't know. But one of the other one, I have a cheating one on this, and that's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because I do not believe that has been, I don't know if it's possible to make a faithful adaptation because everything's so wacky and goofy and whatever. But when you go back to that 2005 movie, which, you know, there are people who love that movie. I can see why they love it and everything, but it the tone of the comedy in that movie is not Douglas Adams. And so it doesn't fit very well. And I don't know, of course, when you read books, you have your own interpretation of how people are speaking and whatever. But hearing the way the characters in that movie are talking, I'm like, I don't feel like it's anywhere near the ballpark of what's going on. So I would like to see a real adaptation of Hitchhiker's Guide, even if it has to be like a TV series or an animated series or something like that. I know they have adapted it millions of times. I know it even started as a radio show before it was even a book. But it would be nice to actually get that series done in a way that I feel like Douglas Adams intended. And I don't think that 2005 version is that, because they're clearly trying to appeal to everybody they can in that movie. Like, let's put a romance in there that I don't really feel like was fleshed out much in the books. Yeah. Going back to the chat on what they wanted to see as far as IP, let's see. Gosh, how far did I need to go up? okay. So Josh says The Dark Tower, that same thing. Like, The Dark Tower was absolute garbage. It does not count. Like, you talking about a series that deserves to have like a really like thoughtful adaptation to it. That movie they came out with wasn't it. Slab says Doctor Who, technically, I guess, that has never had a movie, a theatrical movie.
There was a TV movie that was between the new series and the old series that happened.
We have a Supernatural or Super Wallach. I know Supernatural. I don't know about Super Wallach. Jack and Daxter. James says I'm still waiting for an adaptation of my favorite book, The Curious Incident of the Dog of the Night Time, Dog of the Night Time, from POV of an autistic teen.
Interesting.
That would be interesting. Josh also says Metroid. Slab says, does The Expanse have a movie? I don't think it does. Anything else? All right.
I think you'll definitely see Metroid, especially if the Zelda movie does well and the Nintendo movies keep doing well, you'll definitely see a Metroid movie.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's definitely going to be a thing. Michael says he loved The Three Investigators, so at least I have one person who remembers that.
Kids books. Have there ever been any, do you remember Amelia Bedelia? Does that name ring a bell? Have there ever been any Amelia Bedelia movies? Isn't
that Beverly Cleary that did Amelia Bedelia?
I think so. I think it could have been. Yeah.
I used to read a bunch of Beverly Cleary. I thought Amelia Bedelia is one of them, but she's been adapted a couple of times. I don't think Amelia Bedelia has been.
Interesting.
But yeah, that would be a good one. Let me see real quick. Really good radio. It's not, is it? Authors Peggy Parrish and Herman Parrish. All right. Well, that's going to be our show for today. Next week is Her. I can't wait to see this movie again. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out here and watching us talk about movies today. I think we will be back on Thursday next week.
Tuesday.
Did I say Thursday?
You did say Thursday.
I meant Tuesday. Did I say Happy Camps? Did I say Prison Camp? I meant Happy Camps. We will be back on Tuesday next week. But that's going to do it for the show, and we'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a
part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. I'm on the verge of cutting it off. I like right. it. I like it. And then I'll be like, I'll maintain it. And one of the maintenance days will be like, I don't like this. And then you start doing other things with it. And you're like, man, I really don't like this. And so, I sort of zeroed in on June as being the day that I cut it off. And it was actually like May 31st when I ended up doing it. But yeah, I was like, all right, it's about time and I'll grow it back some other time. But now I'm ready to be clean again. So,
yeah, it's funny. I have the same thing will happen. I mean, I don't grow a great beard anyway. Mine's pretty sparse. So I just kind of, you know, trim it down to more like stubble than a beard actually. But, but yeah, sometimes I'm just like, I just don't like the maintenance and the and then there's just aspects of it, like it'll itch in certain places and I'll just be like, you know, why don't I just get rid of it? And then I get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that I had to learn for a while on the beard building thing is that it will itch for a bit, but once it grows even further out, it'll stop.
Yeah.
That was a big hanging point for me for a while. I'd get to a certain point and I'm like, well, I don't want to deal with this itchiness all the time. But people assured me that if you just let it go, then it would stop. And it does. But yeah, it was just time for it to go. And I am happy to be here at this point. It does look weird though, after about 6 months of having it. So
yeah, there's that initial getting used to, oh, this is my naked face. Yeah. It's interesting. I've been dealing with the same thing with like letting my hair grow like this, like letting it get really long and stuff. And it's just like, I look in the mirror and I'm like, who's that guy? Like I've never had long hair like this before. So then I'll be like, yeah, next time let's just chop it all off. And then I'm just like, no, I kind of like, there is something interesting about experimenting with how you look, right? Like it kind of, it can change bits of your personality, even like there's just ways it impacts. It's one of the fun things you watch, like actors talk about that they find the character once the like hair and makeup is done, you know, because they're like, oh, that's what the guy looks like. So now I know who the guy is, you know, kind of thing.
Right. So I had this mainly because of the way my college life was. I didn't have like a normal barber back in back in my college days, and I had just a mop of hair and I don't grow long hair that comes down to my, I grow out. It comes out.
Yeah.
So like I had a big, huge like fro, I guess, for a lack of a better term, or a perm or whatever the hell you want to call it. It was a big, huge mop of curly hair. And then I think finally it was like, okay, I finally need to cut this. This is just way too much going on right now.
Yeah, the longest I ever had my hair before this was still wasn't like this, because I was shaving like below, so like I let the cap grow long so I could put it in a ponytail or whatever, but then it was still like, you know, I shaved it underneath. Like that was, I don't know, college, I think somewhere in college time. And even then I don't think I let it get this long, but yeah, it's starting to like beyond my shoulders, and I'm just like, I'm not sure I like it on my shoulders. So I may at least like kind of trim it in the back a little bit, but yeah, it's definitely interesting.
Tales from your day two World Series of Poker table. Did you have any interesting interactions with known poker players that day?
The only at my starting table was is it Becker? Was it
yeah, Jeremy, He's Jeremy Becker.
Yeah, Jeremy Becker, who's in the big crossbook thing that's, you know, the poker world knows about or whatever. But I was only there for two hands. We were the first table to break. So yeah, I was at table number one, and they
two hands and they broke it.
Okay, so that's a little bit of an exaggeration. No, I was.
Oh, okay. I was like, holy crap!
I was there long enough to double up, which I think was on the fifth hand. It was either the fourth, or the fifth.
That's not entirely. That's not entirely out of the realm of possibility on a day two, actually.
No,
because there's so many people getting knocked out.
It was crazy. Yeah.
And I had a tournament like that where I had finished day one with, you know, a small amount of chips that I knew I was going to have to double up the next day on and everything. And I just happened to do that in the first five. You have to.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't too long after that. I went to another table right after that.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, that's my exact story. I think it actually was hand four, and the fortunate part of my tiny stack was I was on the button to start. So I had a full rotation before I had to do something. And, you know, if I get trash, I could even let it go another rotation and have just, like, you know, complete fumes. But yeah, on the fourth hand, I had eights, and the person two before me raised, and I went all in, and they called, and they had sevens. Mm. So that was great. Mm-hmm. That was really nice to see. Not a guarantee, but, you know, it's always nice to have somebody nominated. Mm-hmm. And it held up, and so I doubled up, and then, like, two hands late, it never got to my button. So I think it was like one or two hands, or I'm sorry, never got to my blinds. So it was either like, I think it was one hand later or two hands later, we broke. Went to a new table, and had. I forget what it, I think I it wasn't aces. I would have remembered if it was aces, but it was something really good. And so I went all in again. It may have been ace king. So I went all in again and didn't get a call. So then I got those blinds, and so now I'm up to, you know, like, I don't know, 11 big blinds probably. So I'm still in that place where, you know, probably mostly all in. Maybe on rare occasion, if I'm on the button and nobody's done anything, maybe I'll, you know, throw a call or a raise out there. But mostly I'm all in at 11, you know, big blinds, especially when everything's going as fast as it is in this tournament. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really catch much to do anything with for a while. But one of the interesting things while that was going on was when they got to the money jump. Two interesting things about this money jump. First of all, it was $60. They had a $60 money jump. What is this nonsense? Like, what are we doing?
I don't know. I don't know if this factors into it at all. Maybe it is just pure math. They look at the money they have and the amount of percentage of players they want to get paid. And then they, like, you know, here's what our number one, which is what our first place prize is going to be. We'll work our way down.
Yeah.
Maybe, though, they also are thinking we don't want people to tank too much for each pay jump. And so $60 is not enough for people to do the tanking.
Right.
So that's I don't know. It's really annoying. I think most people would rather it just, you know, there's got to be some sort of balance here where the pay jump is higher and you maybe don't pay as many people up front as you do.
Yeah.
That type of thing. So,
well, I just wish it was consistent, because the next pay jump was $300, you know, and that makes sense to me, like a $200 to $300, you know, pay jump or whatever. But anyways, we get to this pay jump, and the guy on the microphone says, "Dealers, stand up at the end of your hand, stop dealing, you know, blah, blah, blah," or whatever. And I think it was because the payout line had gotten so long with everybody that was coming out that they were afraid they were going to miss a tribute, like who was on that bubble or whatever, and they wanted to get it right.
Well, and by the way, unless you absolutely have to get out that day, rookie move to go to the payout line immediately after you get knocked out.
Yeah. So there are two different lines, right? I probably used the wrong one. There's the I don't know what the first line would be called, but they make you go to the, you have to stand up in your seat and they escort you to the,
you have to get the card.
You have to get your card, right? So that's the line I'm talking about. The payout line is a secondary line after you get your card. But but that line was so long that I think they just wanted to get it right. And it took 35 minutes. We stopped playing for 35 minutes for them to figure all this out and make sure that they had it right. And the interesting thing about it is the clock ran for 15 of those minutes. I just why is the, whatever. It's you know, when you have a smaller stack, you kind of want to stick in the blinds where you're at for a little bit, but anyhow. So that was really, really weird that
I guess it's not your card, it's them verifying that you and correct. Your driver's license are the 35th or correct. Whatever.
Yes. You get. Yes. Yeah.
And so, cause they give you the card at the table, but I can see that maybe being a problem because you have to go to that for sure.
Yeah.
I think.
No, they make,
I guess, yeah.
In this tournament, maybe, at least when you got knocked out, you had to stand up at your chair. You couldn't go anywhere until you were escorted to that, line.
Yeah, that's typical. I just it's weird to me. I guess you could have some sort of, can you have any kind of malfeasance though by not going to the table and getting it verified right away? Because it's still 35th or whatever place. And I don't know why I've got 35th in my head.
But, I wish.
Aside from the mandatory things that they make you do, going to the payout cage right after you get knocked out is rookie move. Never do it. Always go do some other thing. And I mean, you're talking to somebody who obviously has been in those lines before, and because I worried, oh, I need to get paid like immediately, right? They'll forget all about me. No, they don't forget about you. Like, I think the entire, like, you can go back. I think you can go back anytime you want to get that cash. You don't even have to go while the tournament's running.
Sure.
You don't have
to. No.
So, go there when there's not a whole bunch of people wanting to get their payouts. Go like it, you know, go in the early, like, this is the one advantage to me waking up early these days. Go there at 5 o'clock in the morning. Right. And just get your payout because there's nobody there. There's not as many people taking care of people at the time either, but there's not very many people just hanging out waiting for payouts.
Yeah. So eventually I picked up King 10 and it folded around to the person right in front of me. They went all in and their range was so wide because I was a short stack and I knew they were, you know, they could be raising with anything just to take the blinds.
Yeah.
So I thought King 10 was good enough. Turned out I was right because they had King 9. However, two nines fell on the flop, and such is poker. And, you know, what are you going to do? So I was out.
King 10, definitely. I mean, King 10's like aces in that situation.
Right,
there's
yeah.
No doubt about it. Yeah. I mean, it's but yeah, again, God, that's the most, that is, of course, the worst thing about poker is having somebody down to three outs, and somehow they get two of them on the, they only needed one, but somehow they get two of them. And you're like,
And then the deck teased me by giving me a possible straight on the river. If a six had fallen on the river, I would have had a straight. But it was not to be. But I was very, very pleased, not only with how I played and the result. I came in 575th out of 18,400 people. That is not bad. And so I was pleased with that. I was also pleased because I was questioning myself on day one towards the end if I was folding too much, if I should have gone all in, if I was like too interested in getting to day two that I wasn't playing my stack right, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like I was being a little too knit. And what I wasn't thinking about then because I didn't know is the bottom payout. Like if I go out first on day two, was 2100 and I was at like 1700 on day one. So it's like a $400 pay jump just to make day two at all. So that made me happy. And then of course I ended up going a little bit further cause I, you know, doubled up and it ended up being a lot of fun. I don't know. It's something you know, this, like when you go deep in a tournament like that, you just think, I mean, these are the best players in the world. Like, this is the World Series of Poker. Like, you just go, okay, like, I know this game. I know how to play. And mm-hmm. you know, certainly luck is involved, and I had a little bit of it. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to sit down with, like, people you've seen on TV play, you know, poker and play well.
Super exhilarating.
Yeah, it's good stuff.